Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Dalia Khanom Yazbek, a research analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Middle East Center in Beirut.
In this episode, we talked about the history of jihadism in Algeria, the growth of GIA networks in Europe and its legacy today, why there haven't been that many Algerian foreign fighters in Syria, especially compared to other North African countries, similarities and differences between the GIA and the Islamic State, and what the current status of jihadism is in Algeria, as well as what Algerian jihadists are up to abroad.
At the end of this episode, we'll have an updated hashtag social media segment covering postings from November 21st through the 29th. But before the interview, we have an updated primary sources section, which is covering releases from October 15th through November 23rd. And just a note, this primary sources section is quite long, so if you'd like to skip ahead to the interview, you can jump to around the 34-minute mark to get right into the interview. But to start off the primary sources section, Aaron, why don't you tell us about the anti-Islamic State releases we've seen during this time period?
On October 16th, Sheikh Abu Munzir al-Shinkiti, a top ideologue within the global jihadi movement for years, though nobody knows who he specifically is, put out a release against the Islamic State and describing how it's destructive rather than a constructive entity, and that all the conditions were present in Iraq for the creation of a legitimate Islamic State as an extension of the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan, referring to the Taliban, but that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi created an illegitimate organization that does not follow the principles of an Islamic State, essentially arguing that it lacks good governance and expertise. And it also runs counter to the prophetic model of governance in relation to Muhammad. And then he highlights a few ways that it goes against this prophetic model of governance. One, that negotiations with enemies, as Muhammad did with Quraysh, forging treaties and agreements so you're not facing all your opponents at once, planning battles carefully so that you're not fighting infidels everywhere, accepting criticism, focusing on facts and truths rather than slogans, not letting victory corrupt morals, promoting love of Islam and jihad among the people rather than terrorizing them, preventing rumors and misinformation from spreading, and protecting the lives of Muslims. Then, a couple of weeks after that, a joint statement was put out on November 1st by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which was read out in a video by one of AQAP's top ideologues, Sheikh Khalid bin Umar Batarfi, also known as Abu al-Miqdad al-Qanadi. In it, he accuses IS of directing their arrows against Muslims rather than the Jews or Crusaders, and instead focusing on that they should be focusing on waging jihad, and that IS has been declaring takfir on jihadi groups and threatening them with violence. And he continues with some similar things we've heard in previous anti-IS statements in the past from Al-Qaeda types. And he concludes in this statement and that he warns that in the end of the statement, he warns that they may go the same way as the armed Islamic group of Algeria, or the GIA, who became too extreme for their own good, which we'll be talking about later in this episode in the interview section, so you'll be able to get more of a context for what he's saying here. And then finally, Jabhat al-Nusra put out a video on November 18th, about a couple of weeks ago, against IS, and stating that they have rebelled against the entire Ummah or Islamic community, and that both IS and the Kharijites, a reference to the historical group that was deemed as deviant from the mainstream, rejected traditional scholarship and ignored scholars and religious texts, and both were too extreme in their practices of takfir, or excommunication of other Muslims, which then justifies in their views the ability to kill these individuals.
And during this month and a half time period we're looking at, the Islamic State has put out many videos on Israel. Can you tell us what these videos contained?
Yes. Oh, so many videos on Israel. In about a couple of day time span, they put out 15 videos. And this is in the context of when, in the news cycle, there was a lot of discussion and articles and reporting on all of the stabbing attacks that had been going on in Jerusalem and the West Bank area. And so the first one that came out was on October 18th from IS's wilayat at Nineveh in Iraq. In it, it provides some history of Al-Aqsa, one of the mosques on the holy sanctuary in Jerusalem. And it essentially begins by talking about its liberation from the Crusaders by Salah ad-Din, and then its betrayal by Arab tyrants and the occupation by the Jews. And it characterizes the current violence as the successor to Salah ad-Din's jihad, trying to link the past to the present. And they encourage these Palestinians in their jihad and advise them to be prepared, and that they should stand united and not be distracted by Hamas, Fatah, and Arab tyrants, and that jihad is the only way to achieve their goals, but and not through negotiations or party politics. And then finally, one of the speakers advises them not to forget the potential for using IEDs, which have been successfully used against the infidels in Iraq and Syria. On the same day, IS's wilayat Kirkuk in Iraq put out a video talking about the enemies of God in Jerusalem think they're safe but do not know that fear awaits them in relation to the Jews in Israel. Then one of the fighters addresses the Mujahideen in Jerusalem, urging them to purify their intention and continue their jihad, an allusion to, you know, not fighting under the banners of groups like Hamas and Fatah. And then the film shows footage relating to the arson attack in Douma that killed members of the Dawabshe family in July this past year. And then the speaker urges the Mujahideen to use their knives and daggers to continue to fight against the Jews. Also on October 18th, Wilayat al-Janub, also a province in Iraq, put out a video as well. In it, Abu Nur al-Ansari stated that the Islamic State will not forget the Palestinians, and he reminds Muslims around the world of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's comments that one day spent in jihad is better than 1,000 days not. Then on the 18th, also another video came out from IS's wilayat al-Fallujah, also in Iraq, and it begins with footage of violence between Israelis and Palestinians, and encourages their brothers in Palestine that there is no life or glory but only in jihad, and offers specific advice on methods, using knives in the heart or chest or striking their enemies with cars. And then saying that actions of the brothers in Palestine have gladdened their hearts, and criticizes parties such as Fatah and Hamas. And at the end of it, one of the speakers recites a poem about the glories of jihad. Also on the 18th, in Wilayat al-Khair, which is an IS province in Syria, the name used for the Deir ez-Zor region, starts by showing images of world leaders meeting with Jewish figures and of Jews praying. And it describes how Jews are allegedly bringing corruption to this earth, and that they will eventually enter Al-Aqsa and raise the flag of monotheism. And at the end of it, one of the speakers draws links between the Shia groups that IS is fighting in Iraq and Syria and the Shia-linked groups in the Palestinian territories, in particular groups like the ones that Iran and Hezbollah have tried to build up, or through conversions such as some members in the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, or even the newer outfit, the Harakat al-Sabarin, which uses a flag with a similar logo to the one that many of the proxy forces that Iran has built up in Iraq and Syria use, as well as similarly to the IRGC and Hezbollah itself. On October 19th, the Islamic State's Wilayat Hadramaut in Yemen put out a video describing Palestine as the land of the prophets and currently ruled over by hypocrites, and that the fight against the Jews is not about territory or land, but a struggle between good and evil, between Islam and unbelief, and that they should not differentiate between the Jews because they do not differentiate between Muslims. And at the end of it, one of the speakers urges Muslims to pledge bayah to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Also on the 19th, in IS's Wilayat al-Barakat, which is in Syria, the Hasaka region, one of the speakers in this video urges Muslims to kill Jews wherever they find them, saying actions bring joy to the Mujahideen, and that their actions should be targeted and focused so that Jews do not feel safe. Also on the 19th, IS put out something from Wilayat Halab, also in Syria. In the beginning of it, the video, it shows footage of alleged Jewish crimes in Jerusalem, and then stating that Palestine can only return through jihad and that the enemies of Islam know that and that the danger it poses to them, and that the issue of Palestine should not be limited to nationalism or Arabism, which led to splits between Fatah and Hamas, both of whom want democracy, which they see as a form of infidelity, but rather should only be done, through the true lens of religion, in this case, Islam. On the next day, on October 20th, IS puts out another video from its Wilayat al-Furat, which is a province that spans the Syrian-Iraqi border between Abu Kamal and al-Qa'im cities, more or less. In it, it talks about the importance of speaking out against nationalism and politics, a theme that we've already heard in relation to Fatah and Hamas. Also, Western and Arab powers have conspired against Palestine in the fight against the Muslims because of their religion, noting that Palestine is the beating heart of the Islamic world and that the whole Islamic community will stand behind them when they fight, and that the brothers in Palestine must not sleep but must seize the opportunity to fight, and that the emphasis is on religion and fighting for Sharia or Islamic law rather than party loyalty or distracting slogans. And then speakers are criticizing Hamas for participating in democratic elections and not ruling in accordance with the Sharia. And then they conclude by discussing history of Syria and Israel and how Hafez al-Assad abandoned the Golan, trying to sort of link in some respects the conflict that they're fighting in Syria with what's happening in relation to Israel. Also on the 20th in IS's Wilayat al-Raqqa, they put out a video highlighting that soldiers of the caliphate are surrounding Jerusalem, and hopefully soon the flag of monotheism will fly there, and that it's important to speak out against nationalism, which is just another type of occupation in IS's opinion, and that Muslims should only fight for religion and Sharia. Also on the 20th in IS's Wilayat al-Jazira, which is a province that spans Syria and Iraq also, but more in the northern parts. The video gives a speech that's sort of a tirade against Jews, describing them as traitors and breakers of promises who attack Muslims and spread corruption. And then the end of it, one of the speakers threatens both the Jews and tyrants, which is a reference to the so-called Arab apostate states in the region, that the caliphate is coming with suicide attackers, emigrants, and supporters. The next day on October 21st, IS's Wilayat Hims, which is another one of its provinces in Syria, puts out a video. In the beginning, it has a historical section that prevents the Islamic State as the heir to the medieval conquerors that liberated Palestine for the Muslims, and that the Islamic State is watching current developments in Palestine as well. A day later, on October 22nd, Wilayat Dimashq, or the Damascus province in Syria, of the Islamic State, in the video discusses the origins of Muslim-Jewish enmity in early Islamic history and then the betrayal of Palestine by the West and Arab leaders who handed it over to the Jews. The video concludes with an IS fighter speaking Hebrew that threatens the Jews and saying that they'll not feel safe anywhere and that the Islamic State is coming to get them. Then a couple of days later, on October 25th, IS put out a video from its Wilayat Khorasan, which is its province and the border regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in it, it urges Palestinians to continue their fight as they suffer the most, and that the Islamic State will support them, and that they pledge to fight the tyrants who block their path until they reach Palestine. And then finally, about a week after that, on November 1st, IS's Wilayat Sina, or their Sinai province, put out a video which starts with a short segment on the importance of Jerusalem in Islam and the history of the city, stating that all Muslims long for the return of Al-Aqsa and that the Islamic State supports the efforts of those using violence against the Jews, and praising the current violence in Israel as successfully terrorizing the Jews and making them live in fear.
And during this time period, we've also had a couple videos put out covering pro-Palestinian messages from non-Islamic State jihadis. Can you talk about what these videos covered?
Sure. So on October 18th, the Nasser Salah Adin Brigades, a militant group in the Gaza Strip, put out a message in support of what was going on with these stabbing attacks in Jerusalem and the West Bank as well. And congratulating their brothers in Palestine on their actions, which they're watching closely themselves. Then about 5 days later, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's Sheikh Khalid bin Umar Batarfi put out a video expressing his grief and sorrow for what's happening in Palestine, says that Muslims cannot stay silent, and that silence among Muslims on what is happening in Palestine is betrayal and prevents victory, and that they must support the Palestinians in whichever way they can. And if there are divisions, they must mend them, because expelling enemies must be the first priority. And that the jihad in Syria is the gateway to liberating Palestine. And he concludes his message by reciting a poem about Palestinians sacrificing themselves for the cause and urging them to be patient. And then the last one of this variety came on October 23rd also from another AQAP ideologue, this time Sheikh Hamad bin Hamoud al-Uthman al-Tamimi, where he praises Palestine and laments its betrayal by treaties and agreements. And he explains how individual jihad can be better than organizational jihad because the individual can escape the constraints placed on groups. America is the head of the snake that protects Israel, as he reminds people, which would not exist without it. The Mujahideen will not forget Jerusalem and will continue to fight until all the enemies of Islam are expelled from the land. And Tamimi recites a poem about the beauty of Jerusalem as he concludes his message.
And during this time, we've also had several articles released by pro-Islamic State ideologues. What did those articles cover?
On October 19th, the first one was put out by Sheikh Hussein bin Mahmoud, who's been one of the biggest pro-IS ideologues that we've seen that isn't a specific member of the group itself. And he put out a statement in response to one of Abu Muhammad al-Adnani's audio messages, who's the official spokesperson of IS. And while he usually is, pro-IS, he actually criticized al-Anani's aggressive tactics in his message toward other Mujahideen groups, arguing that they should be brought around with a softer approach, as unity is the most important thing. But then, while he chides al-Anani there, later in the text, he becomes more apologetic again, where he says, IS is only hard on its enemies because it fears betrayal by hypocrites and it should not be blamed for its harshness. And then he concludes by urging attacks against Russia for their air campaign, including the Orthodox Church, and also urges the killing of Shias and criticizes those who call the Islamic State Kharijites and other names. Even though, as you recall in a previous podcast, bin Mahmoud was talking about the issue of Kharijites, and he was actually saying that it wasn't necessarily a negative thing and that there were some good traits about Kharijites. So it's interesting that he's sort of changing tune a little bit here in regards to that. In another one of his statements on November 14th, in the aftermath of the attack in Paris, he adopts a very sarcastic tone in it, saying that you know, apologizing to Paris that there are people who have not forgotten its outrages against Muslims across the world and insults to the Prophet and who lost their humanity in attacking a football stadium and a nightclub. He apologizes that the terrorists did not understand international law or human rights and that they had the mad idea that the lives of Syrian children are worth as much as Parisian lives. He sarcastically interprets the Quranic verses such as, "Fight in the way of God those who fight you." The terrorists must not know that this verse truly means fight those who fight you, except Western Christians. And in the future, Muslims will accept any torment with a smile and will respond only with statements and articles and speeches rather than causing any harm to people from Paris. In another statement from him 5 days later, which is not of sarcastic tone but more straightforward, he continues what he's talking about Paris attacks. And he firstly tackles the issue of Muslims mourning for French victims and saying that this is not permissible in the least. Then he takes a sidestep, interestingly, and talks about the issue of the definition of the word martyr, which is bandied about and used often. And he says that only God has the power to make someone a martyr. So instead of referring to something as a martyrdom operation, he thinks it's more appropriate to refer to these operations as guerrilla attacks, which is an interesting aside. And then he concludes later on that any sympathy for France, for example, those who claim France was with the revolution and against Assad, is misplaced and a sign of deviant moderation in religion, and such so-called moderates are aligned with the interests of the Crusader Coalition, and that French lives are considered more important than Syrian and Iraqi lives. Everyone knows even the name of the police dog killed in the Paris raids, but no one can name one dead Syrian or Iraqi child, and he hopes for many more dead Westerners. And then he concludes by saying he also makes a final plea for unity among the Muslims, arguing that the infidels managed to unite despite deep ideological and religious differences. And he provides the example of Protestants and Catholics. And that's what we got from him during this time period.
And the Islamic State has also released numerous administration videos during the time we're looking at. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so over this time span, IS put out 9 videos related to administration and governance. The first one came out on October 22nd from Wilayat al-Raqqa in Syria, talking about its protection and safety office. In particular, it highlighted its firefighting service and talking about how it put out different types of fires, but also that it has a diving service to rescue victims of drowning. And that the Protection and Safety Office was recently established after all the necessary equipment had been procured, and that it also works to rescue those trapped in wreckage caused by bombing raids. And the video concluded by highlighting some of the equipment it now had, such as ladders, hydraulic pumps, generators, firefighting suits, and other things. A few days after that, on October 28th, IS's Wilayat al-Barakat in Syria shows off its outreach efforts from its public relations office, highlighting the first element of it is tribal outreach, during which IS members proselytized to meetings of tribal representatives. And it says that they have weekly meetings with these tribes, and that the second element is accepting repentances from infidels. For example, they cite former Syrian regime soldiers, which they have captured. A few days after that, on November 2nd, IS's Wilayat Gharb Ifriqiya in northern Nigeria, previously known as Boko Haram, popularly in the media, put out a video about establishing one of the Hudud penalties upon thieves. And in it, they amputated the hands of 2 men for stealing a bag from somebody's house, highlighting parts of their judicial system and also showing that they're attempting to put out the same type of administration and governance and model, not only in its core territories in Iraq and Syria, but also in its broader expanse of provinces that it's announced in other parts of the world over the past year. On November 4th, then, Wilayat Nineveh put out a video in Iraq where it shows one of its members, Abu al-Abbas al-Ansari, discussing the group's zakat system. And he shows the new Nineveh zakat headquarters, which oversees 4 distribution centers across the province, and explains how officials collect zakat contributions. In the video, he claims that $10,864,260,000 dinars were collected in the Hijri year of 1436, which sort of coincides between October 2014 to October 2015. And help was given to around 9,000 families, with priority given to women and the disabled. And it concludes by saying that IS also distributed medication free of charge and runs orphanages. A few days after that, on November 7th, IS, as we like, Kirkuk in Iraq, shows off its Hizbah officials and them visiting shops and driving around reminding people to attend prayers, and also interviewing these guys and showing the different facets of their work. For example, inspection and monitoring of goods, security patrols, and intelligence gathering on those selling cigarettes, alcohol, and other types of activities like that. And then it showed an example of the Hizbah official adjusting men's clothing, such as rolling up their trousers at the end so it's above their ankles, so that it's in line with what Muhammad did, the way he dressed when he was alive. And then they also showed the burning of a large pile of material, including smoking devices such as hookahs, what appear to be bricks of hash, as well as some literature with magical symbols on it. A day after that, on November 8th, in Wilayat al-Barqa, which is an IS province in eastern Libya, Abu Umar al-Maghribi addresses medical professionals, encouraging them to come and meet the needs for medical services in their self-styled caliphate. And in it, they also show him dressing wounds and giving first aid lessons to other fighters in the IS. A couple of days after that, on November 10th, IS's Wilayat Halab in Syria put out a video about its agricultural administration, comparing its importance to its military efforts, and highlighting how IS has been guaranteeing food supply. In it, it shows how the administration stores grain and distributes it to the mills and bakeries according to the needs of each province, and how bread is delivered to villages and communities. It also discusses the administration of the water supply to make sure water gets to agricultural areas, with footage of crops, fruit, trees, and other things like that. There's also discussion of livestock management, showing the operation of dairy and poultry farms, slaughterhouses, and beehives. Also on the 10th, Wilayat al-Furat of IS had another video about its Hizbah activities. It first started out with a short introduction about the concept of Hizbah in Islam itself, defining it as a function of the Muslim state in commanding good and forbidding wrong for the good of society. And then one member of IS explains to the camera that Hizbah is about the protection of society, and that there are 5 important things related to it: religion, the self, the mind, offspring, and property. And that the Hizbah of IS aims to end corruption, and that there are different types of corruption that are in society. The first is idol worship. The second is alcohol. The third is homosexuality. The fourth is theft. And the fifth is sorcery. And the video concludes with a speaker explaining that the punishments that are conducted in response to these types of corruptions are necessary to maintain a virtuous society. And then finally, on November 11th, IS put out a video from its Wilayat Halab again, this one talking about its training program for its so-called cubs of the caliphate, or the younger children and preteens. And it shows young boys and girls studying in its classrooms, and there's footage of children actually carrying out executions. Then it highlights typical activities of the children being trained by IS, such as physical activity and sports, eating breakfast, and attending classes. It highlights how children are divided up into different classes based on their ethnic or linguistic backgrounds. And then it shows children studying the Quran and the religious material and participating in military exercises such as loading weapons and hand-to-hand combat. And there's also an Arabic language institute so that children can study the language. And of course, the children are split up by gender.
And can you tell us about the one video that Jaysh al-Fattah put out during the time we're looking at?
On November 7th, Jaysh al-Fattah put out a video about its what it describes as its executive force in Idlib in northwest Syria, and that the body is responsible for enforcing Sharia or Islamic law. And it says its first priority is security patrols to make sure the city remains safe. Then they show off some of their officials enforcing parking regulations and responding to a shooting and opening an investigation in light of it. Then a prison officer talks about arresting dissident regime soldiers and handing them over to their Sharia courts and showing footage of prisoners, in particular, in this case, former regime soldiers discussing their past sins and repenting.
And finally, can you tell us about the three videos that the Islamic State put out on Al-Qaeda in Yemen?
Starting on November 16th, so more recently, IS put out three videos about Al-Qaeda in Yemen, though there were some digressions about the Taliban in Afghanistan as well. The first one is from Wilayat al-Khair in Syria, where it criticizes Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and then it criticizes nationalist movements and popular revolutions and movements such as the Muslim Brotherhood. Later on, it shows footage about the Taliban refusing to pledge bay'ah and join IS, and a voiceover in the video criticizes the Taliban's moves towards political negotiations. It also criticizes the Taliban for not acknowledging Mullah Omar's death and questions whether Ayman al-Zawahiri knew and allowed people to be deceived. It also accuses al-Qaeda in Yemen of cooperating with the Yemeni regime, and that Yemeni members of IS then address the camera and ask why al-Qaeda does not rule with Sharia when they take control of towns, and they compare al-Qaeda to the Jews who did not convert to Islam because they know a caliphate has been established and yet have not joined it. And they conclude in this video by warning people in Yemen, the Sunnis, that AQ will not save them. A day after that, on November 17th, IS put out a video from its wilayat Nineveh in Iraq, and it describes how al-Qaeda is deceived from its original mission and has allied itself with nationalists, even atheists such as the PKK, and then describing how in Yemen they have issued statements discouraging killing of Shia and have espoused other positions contrary to Sharia. Then they emphatically state that IS is the strongest against all the enemies of Islam. And it concludes by saying that accusing the Taliban of negotiating with unacceptable partners such as Iran and Pakistan. And a speaker asks how al-Qaeda hopes to achieve their goals when they have deviated so far from the true path of jihad. And then finally, on November 18th, IS's wilayat al-Raqqa in Syria continues in its video with a familiar theme about AQ in Yemen being too conciliatory towards Shia, describes how AQ in Yemen do not rule with Sharia and have formed tacit alliances with the regime, popular militias and groups abroad that IS does not agree with, such as so-called Sahawat or awakening movements in Iraq. And then it concludes with a Yemeni IS member addressing the camera, talking about AQ's deviation, in particular, its support groups such as Jaysh al-Fattah in Syria.
All right, and now here's Aaron's interview with Dalia Khanum Yazbek.
Today, what is happening in Syria has many echoes to what we saw in Algeria in the 1990s. Of course, the background and context was different, but there was the jihadi faction, the GIA, which acted similar to what we now see with the Islamic State, with some seeing it as a predecessor to what is going on. Interestingly, though, there have not been that many Algerian foreign fighters in Syria. To explain this and other aspects of Algerian jihadism, we have Dalia Khanum Yazbek on the show today. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Aaron, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we get into sort of more recent developments, I think it's always important to get a lot of the context and details that has happened previously so people really understand the trajectory of how things got to where they are today. So can you maybe provide a brief background on jihadism in Algeria, its development in the late 1980s, and peak during the civil war in the 1990s?
Yes, of course. What we can say about jihadism in Algeria is that it witnessed two phases. So we have the 80s and then we have the 90s. So the 80s was the period that witnessed the formation of the first jihadist group with the MIA. I will come back to it later. And the 90s, that is the period where jihadist groups proliferated, learned from the mistake of their predecessor, and had a real strike force to destabilize the state. So back to the 80s, the first jihadist group in Algeria was the MIA, which stands for Armed Islamic Group. It was created by Mustafa Bouyali. Mustafa Bouyali was a veteran of the War of Independence and a former member of the FLN, the National Liberation Front. But Bouyali was against the regime and its policy that he judged not really Islamic. So he formed a group at the beginning. The group was fighting non-Islamic behavior and fought, to close bars, pubs, restaurants, this kind of stuff. And then he was arrested a first time in 1981 and the second time in 1982. And everything started when Bouyali went out of jail. He decided to go underground and he decided to create his first jihadist group. So this group attacked on November 7 and 8, 1982. The Cap Janet headquarters of the military, and they stole something like 160 kilos of explosive. So that was really the beginning of the jihadist activities in Algeria. The second attack from Bouyali group happened on November 17 of the same year, 1982, when they attacked a gendarmerie roadblock in Ben Aknoun, in Algiers, outskirts, basically. So the MIA conducted several attacks, among them the attack of the police academy in Soma, one of the biggest attack of their history. But finally, Bouyali was killed in 1987. The members of his groups were killed or jailed, and those who were jailed, they were, jailed until 1990. And then the president of that time decided to offer them an amnesty, so they went out. Among these people, Mansouri Maliani, Shabouti, Abdurrahman Hattab, all these people will constitute the core of the GIA in the 90s. So in the 90s, just to give a little background to our audience, Algeria witnessed the riot of October 5th, 1982. That was a real, real political earthquake in Algeria. It was the equivalent of what happened in the Arab world lately with what some called the Arab Spring. So the regime decided to open up, and this phase was called the Infitah. It was a political Infitah, but also an economic one. And on the political level, the regime decided to proclaim democracy and to establish a multi-party system. So in 1990, more than 150 parties were registered, and among them the FIS, which stands for Islamic Salvation Front. So the party that was very popular was able to win the first round of the municipal and regional election of June 1990. And that, Aaron, was a real shock for the regime, but also for many Algerians, because they didn't realize that the Islamist party was a real aspiration and a real solution for millions of Algerians who saw it as a savior. So once the electoral process was interrupted in 1992, following the overwhelming victory of the FIS at the first legislative election, that when Algeria went into the darkness, if I may say. So the second round, expected to take place in January 1992, never occurred, and the FIS was banned. Its cadre and sympathizer were imprisoned, and the extremist wing of the party issued a call to jihadism. And then several jihadist groups erupted to fight what they called, like IS today, the impious state. And Algeria witnessed a bloody civil war that lasted more than 10 years from 1992 to 2001. However, I want to emphasize on something. Many think that it is the interruption of the electoral process in December 26, 1991 that led to the call of jihadism. But this is not true, because before the interruption of the electoral process, on November 28th, a branch of the MIA that was, formed by former MIA members revived it, the group, and another group, Takfir wal-Hijra, perpetrated the attack of the military barracks in Gamer in South Algeria. So what I can say is that the interruption of the electoral process was more like a catalyst of violence. Before it, the hard wing of the FIS and the MIA took a decision to launch jihadism. So this is on the background. Okay, so then several groups appeared, and among them the GIA. GIA stand for Armed Islamic Group, and that was the first group that proclaimed the caliphate. And as I keep saying, IS in this regard did not really invent anything new. So the GIA witnessed what I can call a golden age, because between 1992 and 1995, 1996, the group was really able to destabilize the Algerian state, and especially, the security forces that had no experience in the fight against terrorism. So one has to recognize that between this period, 1992 and 1994, really the GIA had the upper hand on the jihadists and in Algeria in general. So the GIA was the leader of the jihadist arena in the country. But as I always say, it's the GIA who killed the GIA. Why? Because the GIA, like IS today, was able, to rally a huge part of Algeria. Several population followed the GIA because they saw him really as the savior, as the party and the jihadist group that will change everything in Algeria. So they give him money, they give him all what they could give, and even children. Sometimes in Algeria, and people do not know that, but in some areas in Algeria, when youngsters used to go to the hideouts, to go to jihadist groups, they used to have a huge a party for them, because that was really something to be proud of. So this is to show that really a lot of the population followed him. The people who didn't want to follow either were killed or left their respective regions. But the GIA was pretty popular. But what happened is that, this kind of closed organization, because they evolve in a very repressive environment, which was the case in Algeria, the security forces were fighting them. They eventually develop a paranoia that pushed toward more and more violence against the outside world. So what happened with Algeria is that the GIA, which was supported by several population in Algeria, started to be violent against these same people that helped him. So the beginning of the end started under the era of Zitouni. He was the national emir, and he was pretty violent. But I have to say that the turning point was really under the era of Antar Zouabri. He is very well known for his extreme violence. Antar Zouabri wrote a pamphlet that is called in French Le Sable Tranchant, which is the sharp sword. And in this pamphlet, Zouabri decided to excommunicate the entire Algerian population because of the participation in the first democratic election that Algeria witnessed in 1995. So because the population was tired of terrorism, of terror, of violence, and so on and so forth, and because also the population didn't see any really outcome from this war, they decided to change, and they decided to support those same people that they fought, which were the military. So the excommunication of the entire society, the indiscriminate violence, the radical point of view of the GIA, and the extreme violence against the own its own supporters, and the absence of results, but also the defections that started to be pretty serious in the group, and of course the effort of the Algerian army to infiltrate the group led to its end. Another important factor could be, the beginning of the negotiation between the government and other non-state actors, such as the IAS, which stands for the Islamic Salvation Army. It was the army, the military branch of the FIS. When the government started to negotiate with these non-state actors, with these jihadist groups, the GIA wanted to show that this will make a difference because it has the upper hand on the ground. So they started a real purge against the FIS people, but also against the IAS and against their own allies. And defection started to be more and more important. So basically, this paranoia reached its high point when the GIA started purges among their own groups, and this was late 1996, beginning 1997. 1997, we have to keep in mind that was the year of the mass massacres. Everybody who knows a little bit about the Black Decades knows, for example, about the Bantalha massacre, in which during one night the jihadist group killed more than 417 people. And this year, 1997, was really a turning point because the GIA turned against its own population, and the population didn't want to follow it anymore. So this is when many defections happened, population defection, but also fighters decided to repent, and when others decided to create their own organization. And this is the case for the GSPC, the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat. This group was created by a veteran of the GIA, called Hassan Hattab. He was the former head of the Zone 2 in Algeria of the GIA. And because of the extreme violence of the GIA against the population, Hassan Hattab decided in 1996 to leave the GIA, which he called in another pamphlet a deviationist and a takfiri group. And he was followed by several other people, among them Mukhtar bin Mukhtar, Haj Ali, Ammar Saifi, Abdel Razak al-Para, Sahrawi, and etc. And after 2 years of, if I may say, gestation, the GSPC was born. So, as you know, the GSPC wanted to continue jihad, but didn't want to harm the civilians and the population anymore. So this is why they shifted their strategy from the GIA one, and they wanted to regain the support of the population. So this is why the GSPC attacked only the security forces. And the group actually was first witnessed and noticed in 2002 when they ambushed a military paratroopers in Batna and killed several of them. So after 2 years, the group was scattered by the security forces. Sahrawi, for example, was killed. Abdel Razak al-Para was arrested in Chad and deported to Algeria. And Mukhtar bin Mukhtar was considered disappeared. And Hassan Hattab was placed under house arrest. Another member of the GSPC is Abdel Malik Droutkel, who was not caught. He actually became the emir of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. We will come to that later. He was sentenced to death, in absentia in 2009. What happened after that is that the GSPC in 2007 decided to rally Al-Qaeda and become what we do know today as Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So this organization is pretty active in Europe. From the beginning, it was pretty active in Europe. The first European cells were created in 1998 in Belgium, Spain, and Italy. And actively work with Al-Qaeda. In April 2001, a GSPC cell was dismantled in Milan. And this is, you know, analysts do not really pay attention to that. But these were the first Al-Qaeda cells in Europe. And it was headed by a Tunisian named Issid Sami Khmaïs and the French named Jamel Loiseau. The cell was planning an attack in France, and it was dismantled a year later. But another cell was found in Spain. What the GSPC or Al-Qaeda was doing in Europe, it was that despite, for example, the enmity in Algeria with some groups like Takfir wal-Hijra, they agreed on cooperating when it comes to Europe. So while these two organizations were rivals in Algeria, they seemed to have joint projects in Europe. To give a timeline of the attack of ACME would be too long and too time-consuming, but one has to keep in mind that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb chief, who is Abdel Malik Droutkel, is for a step-by-step application of the Sharia. He, for instance, refused the destruction of the Timbuktu shrines in Mali and called for a less drastic application of the Sharia. He wants the support of the population. This is why he always calls for being more soft. Maybe it's not the right word, but more soft with the population. The objectives of Al-Qaeda today are the same with the former GSPC, overthrowing government, considered as apostate and impious, like the Algerian government, but also the Malian, the Mauritanian, of course, the Moroccan one as well, and the Tunisian, and to install Sharia. ACME today operate in the Sahel region, meaning Niger, Mauritania, Mali, where the group really has a real and strong footholds.
Yeah, before we get to some of the what's going on now, maybe we could rewind a little bit. I think that this will be interesting to some of the people that are listening, in that some of the earliest networks that were built up in France and Europe in the early to mid-1990s started when the GIA was still fighting in Algeria as well. And this led to the hijacking of the 1994 plane, as well as some failed attacks in 1996. Maybe you could walk a little bit through about the rationale for why the GIA decided to do this and how it could potentially inform what we're seeing more recently, since a lot of what is happening now, while the individuals might not necessarily be exactly the same, they're very much a lot of the legacy of these networks that have continued over time.
Yes. The GIA from the beginning announced that the enemies of Algeria was the Algerian state, but also its friends such as France. And France was from the beginning in the GIA agenda as being an impious state, and they wanted also to punish France for all the colonial massacre that they did. So, as you said, the first attack happened with the hijacking of the plane, but also in Saint-Michel in the metro of Saint-Michel in 1995, in which several people died, but also 150, I think, person were wounded. So the problem is that And this is perhaps not politically correct to say it, but the problem is that when the repression started in Algeria against the FIS cadre and sympathizer and all these very pretty extremist Islamists, France did not agree with the Algerian government. And France opened its borders and welcomed the leaders of the FIS and many other extremists under the ground of the protection of freedom of speech and human rights protection. So what these people did is that they directed the FIS and the GIA from abroad. So several were operating from France, but also from Great Britain. Aaron, today everybody knows that the mosque of Finsbury Park was a GIA almost headquarters. So during all these years, those individuals from the GIA, FIS, etc., built up their network. They gathered money, they gathered weapons, and they started, to have a real agenda in Europe. I mean, to think about what they could do in Europe. Lately, with the Charlie Hebdo attack, for example, the French security forces realized that the Kouachi brothers who perpetrated the Charlie Hebdo attack were very close to a guy called Farid Benyitou. Farid Benyitou was close to the GSPC and the GIA himself, and he was the first one to be connected and to open, the what we call La Filière des Buttes Chaumont, the branch of the Buttes Chaumont in the 19th district of Paris. He was a predicator in the mosque Dawa that was sending jihadists to Iraq. The people behind this branch, they are former GIA members, among them Jamal Baghel, Smail Eid Belkassem, Khaled Khalkhal, and etc. So there is, if I may say, a laissez-faire. The French authorities really didn't pay attention to all these GIA, GSPC fighters, and they let them do and they let them be. So I personally, when the Charlie Hebdo attack happened, and when I get the name of the Kouachi brother, Farid Benyitou, all these names were already very known in Algeria in the 90s, but the French government didn't really take them seriously. So, Charlie Hebdo attack, and also what happened lately with the attack of the Bataclan, if I may say, are really not surprising at all, because I think French is really paying the price, and a hefty price, for its security laissez-faire.
Yeah, and we could say that even though we're talking about Algeria specifically and France in particular related to this topic, you could say in many ways we've seen a similar trend happen in other European countries as well. As with other nationals that went there in the early to mid 1990s, to focus more on what's going on now, though, one of the interesting things about the Syrian conflict and relatedly what's been going on in Iraq, and you've written a little bit about this, is that while Algerians have historically been involved in a lot of activities, whether in Algeria or in the Sahel region, or even in France and Belgium, we really haven't seen that many Algerian foreign fighters going to Syria and Iraq. I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about why that is.
Yeah, of course. And actually, I wrote a piece about that entitled Why Algeria is Not Exporting Jihadists in Syria. While I did some field work in April 2015, and I was really interested about this question, because as you said, we had a history of jihadism. And I thought, a hypothesis would have been like, Algerian would be the first one to enroll and go help their brothers, between quotes, as they helped the Afghan in 1979 when they were under Russian attack. But I found out that there is three very important factors that they if I may say, allowed Algeria not to export jihadism. So the first one is the mass trauma of the Black Decade. The second one is the Dawa Salafiyya. And the third one is a very tight and merciless security system. So let's come back to the first one, the mass trauma of the Black Decade. So as I said, Algeria witnessed a very bitter civil war between 1992 and 2002. And this caused a real and a huge mass trauma that is still evident in Algerians' yearning for order and stability. And actually, the authorities are playing, you know, with that feeling of we want security at any price. So Algerians still worry that the country might revert to its previous state of unrest and that Algeria will witness what we witnessed in the 90s. And I talked to many Algerians, starting with my own family and, of course, with other people around me. And, you know, you always hear them saying basically the same thing. We really want change, but we won't pay a bloody price for a change. We want a change, but we want a peaceful change because we've already gave too much. So, you know, Algerians really want that change to happen. And we could see, for example, that they were against, some of them were against the fourth mandate of Bouteflika. But despite that, they really want the change to happen in a very peaceful way. And the images that they are coming every day from Syria, from Iraq, but also from Tunisia and from Libya are really like, you know, a shock for them because this reminds them what they lived in the 90s. And the Algerian authorities, you know, have capitalized on this deep trauma and fears of instability. Just to give you an example, in 2014, when President Bouteflika decided to go for a fourth mandate, his you know, slogan was very, very enlightening in this regard because the slogan was stability and continuity. So the assumption was if you vote for me, you will have stability and continuity and peace. But if you do not, anything could happen. So this is the first very important element. The second element is the Dawa Salafiyya, or what we call in English the quietist Salafism. So, you know, many Algerians who followed the FIS, but also who followed the GIA and etc., were very disappointed about the violence, about the civil war, and so on and so forth. So the quietist Salafism is for majority of them an alternative to both jihadism and politics, and its co-optation by the state, because many Islamist groups are perceived by the population as parti du pouvoir, the state parties, because they've been co-opted. So there is no real trust among Algerian for these Islamist party. So they follow what is known today as the Dawa Salafiyya, which is an alternative movement that preaches adherence to what it says are pure Islamic teaching. And that is an apolitic political movement. And because it is apolitic, you know, they don't do really politics, it is seen by many Algerians are a real and genuine movement. And today we have figures such as Ali Farkous, Abdel Ghani Awasat, Mohamed Chalabi are the real figures of Dawa Salafiyya, and they offer guidance. They are also, you know, 2.0 preachers because they have online platforms, they have Facebook page, they are on radio, and they give to their audience guidance on very, very diverse subjects such as, you know, voting, work, food, prayer, marriage, etc. So basically, to summarize, Dawah Salafia offers, you know, a real alternative for those Algerians who supported the Islamic Salvation Front but were disappointed. And they also offer the followers economic and social support through a system of network. So the followers feel that they do belong to this community, and this is a very important feeling, you know. They have a belonging feeling. They have their own mosque, their own association, their own scholar, as I said. They dress in a very particular style, and the security forces and the government let them be. Now the question is, why the security forces let them be? And I talked to several people from the People's National Army, and as one of them stated it in my interview with him, and I am quoting him, he told me, "We let them be because they are not a menace. On the contrary, actually, they are a good means for the youth to channel and cope with their anger and frustration." And this will lead us to the third point, which is a tight and merciless security mechanism. You know, today Algeria has a very important security system. We have one of the biggest military in the region. Algeria military has an active frontline force of more than 500,000 men, and an active reserve force of 400,000 men. And of course, as many analysts and center showed it, Algeria is the first weapon buyer in Africa, with military spending exceeding $10 billion. But of course, what Algeria has and other countries do not have in the region, notably Tunisia, Mali, Libya, etc., is a real experience on fighting terrorism. We are talking about an army who fought terrorists and jihadist groups for more than 10 years. They have a very sophisticated training, and they have an extensive experience. And this is what allowed them, among the other two factors, not to export. This is what allowed Algeria not to export jihadists to Syria. But of course, that do not mean that there is no jihadist cells in Algeria. As I said it, there is still a jihadist activity, but it is highly localized. It is in the Kabylie region, where the topography of the region makes it very hard to fight terrorism. And of course, the most recent example of this jihadist activity that is still going on in the country is the ambush that was perpetrated against the army convoy in Ain Defla in July 2015.
Yeah, thanks for getting into some of the many factors that we have seen for why there haven't been the same amount of foreign fighters as, in other North African countries, like we've seen the large amounts in Libya, Tunisia, and Morocco, for that matter. One of the interesting things that I think would be interesting to touch upon that, is discussed by many people, whether it's analysts, but even some of the more mainstream Islamist actors inside of Syria, sort of as an argument against the Islamic State, is that it's sort of just like the GIA, and that it's very takfiri, essentially calling people apostates, and therefore it's legitimate to kill them. I was wondering, maybe based off of your understanding of the GIA in Algeria, as well as what we're now seeing with IS in Syria, what are some of the similarities between these two organizations, but also how do you see them as being different?
As I said earlier, I personally do not think that the IS invented anything new. The GIA was the first jihadist organization to proclaim a caliphate in Algeria, and they wanted to expand it. In this regard, really, IS did not invent anything. But today, IS recognized it itself. They learned from the mistake of the GIA, and there is, I don't remember which one, but there is an issue of Dabiq, the official magazine of IS, in which they talk about how the GIA was an example for them and how they are going to not to fail where the GIA failed. But I think the best and the greatest difference between the two is that the GIA didn't back then have what IS has today, meaning the technology. I do believe that IS force do not remain in its military power, but more in its audiovisual capacities. IS have an amazing equipment. They have cameras, they have computers, they have several equipment, very high-tech equipment, that makes them enter millions of houses by a few clicks. This, the GIA didn't have. The GIA used to do its own propaganda by, you know, spreading videotapes and with preachers and so on and so forth. So the Islamic State has shown great capabilities more than more in the virtual sphere than on the field. And I have to say that I mean, if you compare the IS, for example, to the GIA or even to Al-Qaeda propaganda, it is they are completely has been. Today, the Islamic State is a project of its time. It's a 2.0 jihadist group, and they do know how to make use of media as a part of its arsenal. If today the IS is capable of enrolling thousands of European, of Moroccan, of North African too, and convince them to join them, to join it in Iraq or in Syria, it's first of all because of the powerful communication strategy of this organization. So I do believe that this is a huge difference. But I do believe also that IS will probably know the same fate as the GIA, and only IS will kill IS.
Yeah, so we'll see that potentially play out. You know, we've already seen a number of people trying to go against it locally in Iraq and Syria.
Exactly.
Though obviously, in some ways, what's going on now is a bigger phenomenon, and as you noted, the media aspect, which might make it take longer than before. And there's obviously more or larger sort of geopolitical stakes here than, say, Algeria, with all the larger powers and regional powers involved in this conflict. But sort of shifting back to Algeria itself, maybe you could briefly touch upon what the status of AQIM is in Algeria today, as well as what it's been trying to do in Mali and Libya. And then finally, sort of, what's the deal with the Islamic State's so-called Wilayat al-Jazair, and what's going on there, since it hasn't really made a lot of noise in many ways since the original announcement of its creation about a year ago?
Exactly. So, as I said, Algerian security also, they largely succeeded in preventing armed Islamic groups from returning, but we still witness a pretty high localized jihadist activity in Algeria, mainly in the Kabylie region, as I said, but also in the Sahel. The rising instability in Libya, where IS is becoming is mushroomed since the collapse of the Gaddafi regime in 2011, has led to an increase in weapons and drug traffic at the borders. Aaron, there isn't one day almost in Algeria without which you do not hear about the army intercepting drugs or traffic. So the porosity of the borders is a really a huge, huge problem for the whole region, but especially also for Algeria, because these groups have been strengthening their network by searching for regional allies, which wasn't the case before. And what showed us that is the coalition formed between Mokhtar Belmokhtar and the Movement for Unity and Jihad in West Africa, well known as the Mujao. And the Mujao attacked, for example, the gendarmerie barracks in Tamanrasset and Wergla in 2012. And these regional alliances were also evidenced by the 2013 terrorist attack of the gas facility of Ain Aminas by, again, Mokhtar Belmokhtar and his international commando. These attacks show the links and interrelation between various terrorist groups in Algeria, Tunisia, Mali, and Libya, from which the attack was launched. This is when it comes to Akim. Another problem is also that Algeria is single-handed when it comes to the war against terror, because Tunisians do not have the means and do not have the experience. Libya is a hotbed for IS, and Mali has only something like 22,000 fighters. So this is not enough. So Algeria is really struggling against terrorism by itself and is single-handed again. And as as showed by the attack of the hotel of Bamako, Akim is still present in the region, and they still want to strike the Algerian government, but also the Malian, etc. So the terrorist organization is really present, is working on quality attacks, and we will probably witness more low-scale, high-impact attacks. When it comes to IS in Algeria, and I wrote a piece about that, I do believe that IS in Algeria is just a publicity stunt. Many groups understood that IS is like a franchise today. It's a brand. It's like Coca-Cola or Nike, and it sells very good. So many individuals and groups are proclaiming allegiance to al-Baghdadi and IS just because the name is pretty important today. And the proof of that is what happened in 2014, with this this group called itself Jund al-Khalifa that attacked and kidnapped the French national Hervé Gourdel and killed him. Abdelmalek Gouri was a veteran of the GIA, and all what he wanted to do was a publicity for himself in order to rally more and more people. But Abdelmalek Gouri was caught and killed by the security forces approximately 2 months after the death of Gourdel. Another emir came after him and declared also allegiance to IS. He was also killed a few months later. So this shows, on the one hand, it shows the capabilities of the Algerian military. On the other hand, it shows the non-viability of these groups. Today, they don't have any possibility to mushroom, if I may say, or to establish themselves in Algeria because of several elements among them, the mass trauma of the Black Decade. People don't want it anymore. They don't believe in jihadism anymore, and they don't want to fight that way. And another element is that IS plays a lot on the Sunnah-Shia dichotomy, and this won't work in Algeria because the makeup of the Algerian population do not provide a good ground for this kind of of dichotomy. So I do believe it's only a publicity stunt and it won't really do anything. Perhaps what they might do and what we might witness is small attacks from time to time on the security forces. But honestly, I don't think that IS in Algeria has any future.
Yeah, it's sort of similar to what we've seen of AQIM in some ways, in that on the whole, most of the time, many of their attacks are just on soldiers and policemen, and that they're very low scale and nothing near what it used to be back exactly. in the day. So.
Al-Qaeda is one of the oldest, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is one of the oldest jihadist organization in the region. And its emir, who is Abdelmalek Droutkel, I do not think that he will accept the fact that his organization, that is the oldest and the most, the oldest based there, will accept that this organization will become just a branch of IS in the region. I don't think that Droutkel will accept that. And I don't think also that, Akim in general will accept also the ideology of IS, because despite the fact that they are both, terrorist organization, between quotes, terrorists, I hate this word because it's very, it's like a fourtout word. You can put everything and nothing in it. But despite the fact that Akim is a jihadist organization, Akim, since the beginning, since the GSPC and from there, is really attacking principally security forces. And this is the whole point. When Hattab left the GIA, he left the GIA because he called it a takfiri organization, because it was killing civilians. What is IS doing today is also killing civilians. So that will be a totally against the ideology of Akim today. So I don't think we will witness anytime soon a collaboration between the two. By the contrary, I think that Akim, if IS start to be more active in the region, in Algeria or in the Sahel, they will fight it, and we will witness what we witnessed in Algeria in the 90s between the GIA, the IES, the MIA, and the different Takfir wal-Hijra, etc. A real war between these small groups. They will kill each other.
Yeah, and we've already seen similar things happening, of course, on a larger scale in Syria. Everybody knows between IS and Jabhat al-Nusra, but even, between the Taliban and IS's wilayat Khorasan. And more recently, you've seen that al-Shabaab in Somalia has tried to purge the elements of their defectors that have pledged bayat to IS. But anyways, thanks for coming onto the show today, Dalia, and getting into some interesting historical trends and details that are still relevant to what we're seeing today in various parts of Europe, but also the broader Middle East and North Africa.
Thank you, Aaron. It was a pleasure.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from November 21st through the 29th.
During that time span, two foreign fighters were announced killed by IS in Iraq, while also during that time span, three foreign fighters were announced killed by various groups in Syria, and AQAP announced 34 military operations over that eight-day period.
On November 22nd, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State shows off its control and inspection office.
On November 23rd, Liwa Shuhada al-Yarmouk, an IS front, graduates a new class from its training camps in southern Syria.
Also on the 23rd, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State constructs nurseries for plant production.
On November 24th, Wilayat al-Jazira of the Islamic State begins building a new mosque in Tel Afar, Iraq.
On November 25th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State manufactures agricultural machinery.
On November 26th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State shows off the Habib bin Muslima al-Fihri Elementary School.
On the 26th as well, Wilayat Dijla of the Islamic State shows off one of its asphalt plants.
Also on the 26th, Wilayat al-Janub of the Islamic State graduates a new class from its Abu Abdurrahman al-Baylawi military training camp.
On November 28th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State turns gravel roads into asphalt roads to make trade routes more efficient.
Also on the 28th, Wilayat al-Fallujah of the Islamic State plants new lettuce crops.
And on the 28th as well, Wilayat al-Anbar of the Islamic State rehabilitates a building and turns it into a new restaurant in Al-Hit City, Iraq.
Finally, on November 29th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State puts up new Dawah billboards in Sirte, Libya.
If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the podcast, please check out the Patreon link in the show notes, where you can make a small donation to help support the show and get some cool bonus content and other rewards. As always, you can find the show on Stitcher and iTunes, and if you use one of those platforms to listen to us, please leave a rating and review, which will help more people discover the podcast.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Dahlia for coming onto the show and sharing her expertise with us. Also, thanks to the Podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly, and to Elizabeth Carruthers for helping with background research on the primary source material. Until next time, I'm out.